For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and coming up in today's show, author Lissa Evans with a bittersweet tale of what the suffragettes did next.
But when I started reading about former suffragettes, I was really astonished by the directions in which they went.
Author Anthony McGowan presents RNIB with a fantastic 150th anniversary gift.
I rather rashly volunteered to read three of my quite short books, Brock, Pike and Rook, and I thought it might be fun to do this, and how wrong I was.
Actor Samuel West discusses political chicanery and the Moomins.
If the Moomin books are ever re-recorded and I don't get to do them, there will be trouble.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. Lissa Evans has many strings to her bow. She qualified as a doctor, has been a stand-up comedian, won awards for her work as a director and producer of comedy on TV and radio, and is the author of critically acclaimed books for both children and adults. Her children's book, Wed Wabbit, was shortlisted for this year's Silip Carnegie Medal, and her latest book for adults, Old Baggage, has just been published. So, when she came into the studio, we had plenty to talk about. Lissa Evans, welcome to Read On.
Thank you very much.
Old Baggage is really a very timely novel. Feminism is split now and was split 10 years after the suffragettes first achieved success.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, it was astonishing to me reading about what happened after the First World War. I hadn't known about it. I knew I wanted to set my book amongst older suffragettes. I'd already established the character of Matty, the lead character, in another novel. And I wanted to take her back to my age. I'm 58, and I wanted to see what was going on in the head of a 58-year-old former suffragette. But when I started reading about former suffragettes, I was really astonished by the directions in which they went. And I used an analogy in the book that together as a single cause they shouldered down the door, but then momentum took them in myriad different directions. And so you had former suffragettes who simply retreated back into a sort of private life. You had former suffragettes who became teachers or MPs or embraced a different single cause, for instance, Home Rule in Ireland or the slightly weird religion of Theosophy, or they entered the professions, or, and I stumbled across this, several of them became fascists. And this was quite chastening and quite interesting, provided the sort of impetus for the plot.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I listen to programmes such as Women's Hour and you hear feminists slugging it out between each other and you just think, but in a world of Donald Trump, you really should have a common enemy again.
Well, I think feminism is synonymous with discussion. So I don't think you... And also, without this single cause, there's too much going on in the current world for everybody, I think, to embrace the same view. What happened with suffragism in the early parts of the 20th century, and it was known as feminism then. It's funny, we think of it as a new word, but it was called feminism. After the First World War, it split into old feminists and new feminists. And the old feminists were the ones who were still trying to achieve equality in everything, and the new feminists were the ones who wanted to get more help for women in the home, for instance, child benefit. And the splits went on and on and on splitting, and it wasn't really until the 70s it coalesced again. So I think that's the nature of feminism.
And you set the book 10 years after the initial success in 1928, when women over the age of 21 have just achieved the vote.
Yes.
And yet for your hero, Matty, the war is not over.
The war is not over because equality has not been achieved in all things. The vote is simply a symbol of freedom, and yet freedom is not for everybody. And she is somebody who's got this magnificent past. She has fought, she has talked, she was a public speaker, she heckled Winston Churchill, she smashed windows, she was in prison, she was force-fed. She experienced the fantastic camaraderie of the suffragette movement. And ever since the end of the First World War, she has been treading water. And she in her encounter with a fascist who is trying to get together a youth group, Mattie realises that the current crop of young women do not seem to be politicised in any way. They may be getting the vote, but they don't know what they're voting for. And Mattie decides to politicise them with a group which she calls the Amazons, which are a group of girls, cross-class, who run wild on Hampstead Heath.
It's a wonderful vision of these young women of all classes learning how to use slingshots and arrows.
That's
and,
right. And, that's right. Some woodcraft folk with weaponry is how I think of it, yeah. Yeah.
And Mattie's flatmate, the Flea, is a health worker in the East End, and she really does show just how little the vote changed lives of working class women.
That's exactly right. I mean, this book is as much about class as it is about feminism. And that's quite true, that the vote in 1918 was for women over 30 and for women with certain property qualifications. And in the lives of most women, particularly working class women, very, very little had changed. They had no autonomy. They had no income. If their husbands weren't working, they had no income of their own. Unless they worked, they had no pension. They had no real rights to their children. They had no free health care. Life was a drudgery. And that had not changed at all. And I wanted that contrast between Mattie, who is solvent, who was born into a fairly rich family and is rich, and the Flea, Florrie Lee, that's why she's called the Flea, who comes from a working class family, who has worked her way into a profession, but who still sees every day the unchanging nature of women's lives. And I actually came across a PhD on the net called Sanitary Ladies, which was about sanitation and health workers. The Flea is both, and that was quite common. She qualified as a sanitary inspector during the First World War and then would have been gently ousted by the men coming back afterwards and would have moved more into health visiting. And this PhD was marvellous. And in fact, I tried to find the writer to thank her and could never get hold of her on the phone. So I've written her name in the acknowledgements anyway.
In the 70th anniversary of the foundation of the NHS, it's rather a timely reminder of what life was like before there was a National Health Service.
Absolutely. I've got some of Florrie's notes in the book, and she visits a family where there are numerous children. Previous children have died. The children now are ailing, and there's no proper help. The mother has heard of these things called sunshine homes, where you could send your children by the seaside, and they were sort of charitable foundations. But her husband is sick. She's got no pension. She's got no income whatsoever. She's dependent on local guardians to give her money, and also, more importantly, she has no access to contraception. And even if she had, her husband wouldn't approve.
You're dealing with some very weighty issues. The thing that might not come through the conversation so far is it's a very funny book. Mattie is... she's almost as complacent as some of the younger women she sees around her because of her class background, which makes her a little bit pompous. It is character, I suppose, that is the secret of good comedy, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. The ideal radio script, the way radio scripts are set out visually, is the name of the character is on the left and the dialogue is on the right. It's different to TV scripts. And ideally, you should be able to cover up the names of the characters on the left and still know who is speaking. And that is the core to it. If you know your character's voice, and you can use it in order to both forge plot and comedy. And for me, it's not sort of conscious decision to write funny dialogue. It just seems to be the way I write. When I discovered how I wrote, which was eventually in my 30s, having tried to write my whole life, this was my voice, this is the way I write. But it all comes from the character. I generally come up with a character and a setting, a vague idea of what happens in the end, and then I see where it goes. And I want it all to be believable within the context. I never want the reader to think, oh, that wouldn't happen, because everything happens through the characters. So Mattie sort of arrived in my head and chained herself to my consciousness completely whole. I knew Mattie right from the beginning. Doesn't mean I knew every decision. I mean, there's a bit in Old Baggage where there's a sort of flashback to when she first votes in 1919. And I thought for quite a long time, what would Mattie have voted? She comes from a moneyed background. She has an income. A natural cast of her mind might well be conservative. On the other hand, you know, she was radical in many ways. So maybe. And I thought about it for a long time. And I thought in the end, Mattie couldn't bring herself to vote for any of the main parties. She couldn't bring herself to vote for a party which would make laws which she Mattie Simpkin, would then have to obey, because all the parties had let her down again and again. And in the end, she votes for an independent, a licence for every dog. And I thought, yeah, that's Mattie. She's a contrarian.
The first book of yours that I read was Their Finest Hour and a Half, which again is a super comic novel about the British film propaganda unit in the Second World War that was made into a film with Bill Nighy a couple of years ago,
yes,
called The Finest. Do you prefer using historical fiction to point at the foibles of our life nowadays?
It's funny how it happened, really. I wrote two novels that were roughly contemporary, set in the sort of 90s. And I wanted to write a book about being behind the scenes. You know, in television, in radio, I'd been a producer, I'd been a director, I'd been spent hours in the writer's room. I knew that milieu. But I did think, you know, does anybody really want to read a book about telly? You know, who cares? And from my whole life, really since the age of about 12, I've been very, very interested in the home front. My father was given a book when I was 13 by my elder sister, who was a sociology student at the time, and it was called How We Lived Then. And it was the first sort of collection of memoirs and recollections of the home front during the Second World War. It's not a particularly political book. There have been more sociological studies since then. It's a book of detail. And my father said, what do I need to read this for? I lived through it. So I took the book and I read it and reread it and reread it. And it was fascinating for a child, because it was everyday life. What did you eat? What was in your Christmas stocking? How did you get to school? Who was at school? Who was teaching you? What did you feed your pets? And I loved all that and I absorbed it and I remained interested in it for life. And so round about the time I was thinking of writing a book about behind the scenes in telly, I was also reading a biography of, I think, Hollywood actors. And there was a quote from an actor called George Arliss, who was huge between the wars. He sort of disappeared now. But he had said, once work begins in the studio, nothing in the outside world is of any relative importance. And I thought, God, that is so true. You know, because the whole thing about being behind the camera is everything seems so important. And then 3 minutes later, you think, what was I worried about? You know, why did it take 10 people to decide whether it was a bowl of, you know, apples or oranges in the back of shop? And I started thinking about whether that had been true during the Second World War as well. When actual bombs were dropping outside the studio, did it still take 10 people to decide on the colour of the leading man's tie? And I started researching and I thought, yes, it hasn't changed. I can write this. I've got the perfect dramatic background and I know this world because writers haven't changed and producers and directors haven't changed. And it was a melding of something I knew absolutely and something I'd always been interested in. So that was how I came to write that. And then when I finished Their Finest Hour and a Half, which took me ages, because once I started writing, I realised I was writing the whole plot of a film. There was no, you know, I couldn't cut to the end. I had to write the whole thing. So when I finished, I thought, oh, I'm going to write a nice contemporary novel. I'm going to do nothing with any research. But I had so much still in my head that I ended up writing another Second World War novel, Crooked Heart.
One of many other strings to your bow is your children's writing. And I certainly found reading Wed Wabbit, which was shortlisted for this year's Philip Carnegie Award, the most entertaining book on the list, actually. It made me weep with laughter. Give me a quick synopsis.
OK. It's so difficult giving a synopsis of Wed Wabbit, I have to say. It's about a sensible, straightforward girl called Fidge who lives with her mother and her little sister Minnie, who's rather imperious. And every night, Minnie makes Fidge read to her from the same book, a really appalling book called The Land of Wimbly Woo, which is about these characters called Wimbly Woos, who are sort of like coloured dustbins, having happy adventures in rhyme. And Fidge can't stand this book. Anyway, there is an accident that's partly Fidge's fault. Minnie lands in hospital. Fidge goes to stay with her awful spoiled cousin Graham. And in an excess of rage and misery, an electrical storm takes her and Graham and a couple of other characters into the land of Wimbly Woos. It's about a sensible person having to deal with a mad world. If you think of Claire Balding in Teletubbies land, that's the sort of thing we're dealing with. And so the Wimbly Woos all talk in rhyme, which is very difficult to cope with, obviously, for Fidge. Graham is horribly spoiled. There are two other characters. One happens to be an elephant who's a positivity coach. The other's a life-size plastic carrot who's a psychoanalyst. But I have to say, I think the plot is rigidly controlled and it all works. It's not anarchy.
I've given it to younger children, 9 years old, which I guess is the age that it was originally written for. Oh. My 18-year-old daughter snatched it out of my hand. I spent a weekend in absolute hysterics. I mean, it's, as you say, Alice in Wonderland. There's an element of the secret garden to it as well.
Well, there is exactly. That's exactly how I started writing it. I was thinking about an update for the secret garden. And in the end, I didn't go down that route, but I took the relationship at the centre of the secret garden, which is between a slightly isolated, sensible girl who's perhaps not very demonstrative and a spoiled, miserable, hypochondriac boy. And I took that relationship and put it somewhere else. So that's exactly where it started, yes.
And as you say, anybody who has ever come across a life coach in any way, shape or form should read this book because...
I loved writing Ella. She's tremendously positive, but she often can't join in the physical activities because she's hurt her back during a circus skills workshop. I did enjoy writing it.
And you read the audiobook?
I did. I had various audiobooks read before, often very nicely, but I spend a lot of time constructing my funny lines, a lot of time constructing the jokes. And I quite often use italics in my book so the reader can see exactly where the emphasis goes. And with Wed Rabbit, I could not bear to hear somebody may be missing those jokes. And though I might not be the best actress in the world, I know exactly how those jokes should be told. And so that's why I did it. And I had there are lots and lots of different characters in it, and all the different colours of Wimbly Woos have different characteristics. So I got a sort of voice for each, and I recorded them on my phone so that if I needed to know what a grey Wimbly sounded like, I had to hear a little bit of it, and I would use that. And I love doing it. Absolutely love doing it. But Wed Wabbit himself, who's the tyrant to his... who has become the dictator of Wimbly Land, has an incredibly screechy voice. And I absolutely shredded my vocal cords doing it. I was hoarse for 2 days afterwards.
Have you got enough voice to give us a little bit of a Wed Wabbit line?
Unless you wipe those wongs, the reward's womb will not be for you! Monty Python was more than a small inspiration for that, I think.
And so what are you working on now, children's or adult?
Well, both, but that makes me sound incredibly dynamic and marvellous, whereas I'm actually a very slow writer. It's sort of like in Ben-Hur, where he's on the chariot with two horses, only I've got a snail in each hand drawing me forward slowly. I'm working on the sequel to Crooked Heart. So chronologically, Old Baggage starts, and then there's Crooked Heart. And now I'm writing the sequel to that, which is set 4 years after the end of Crooked Heart. And so it's towards the end of the Second World War, which is not an era I've researched before. I was very, very specific about how I researched. So it's set in the era of the V1s and the V2s, about which I've been reading a tremendous amount. And it's very chastening. I mean, the winter of 1944 in London was... Even though it was pretty certain that we were going to win the war by then, the Allies were going to win, nevertheless, it was utterly miserable time. There was tremendous death and devastation from the V2s, which were rockets you couldn't even predict were coming, would just appear. That was that. You were either dead or you weren't. There was rotten food and very little of it. And it was the coldest winter in living memory. It was absolutely horrendous. So I'm writing about that. And then a children's book. I've just started a children's book and I can say nothing about it apart from the fact that I'm struggling slightly.
Well, I hope you'll come back on to Read On and tell us about them both when they're finished.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Ray.
Lisa Evans, thank you for being a guest.
My pleasure. Right, I'm going to give a little reading from Old Baggage. This is at a point where Matty has been brooding about the lack of politicisation of younger women. and it takes place outside her house in winter. It's very cold outside, and she's discovered a couple of calisthenic clubs in her cupboard and has been swinging them around, and her maid Ida, her young maid Ida, has come across her. Right. As a matter of fact, Ida, I've been meaning to ask you one or two questions. Don't be alarmed, it won't take very long. How old are you? 15, Miss Simpkin. And can you tell me the names of three great women of history? Beg your pardon? Three great women of history. There is no right or wrong answer. I'm simply interested in your response, the first three that spring into your mind. Ida struggled for an answer. Queen Victoria? Queen Elizabeth? She stared at the vegetable patch, as if the crossed pea sticks might give her some inspiration. They did. The Virgin Mary. I'm not sure that... No, never mind. What can you tell me about Dame Millicent Fawcett? Anything? No? What about Mary Somerville? She had a famous institution named after her. You mean the prison? No, that's Pentonville. What about Mrs. Emmeline Pankhurst? What do you know about her? She threw a brick at the king's horse? Matty absorbed the blow. And which politician do you most admire? Politician? Yes, is there a politician that you admire? Ida glanced round rather desperately, wondering when she was going to be allowed indoors. Which answer would get her into the warm? Mr. Baldwin? She suggested. The Prime Minister. Yes. And if you could vote tomorrow, who would you vote for? There was a pause. Mr. Baldwin? Said Ida again, hoping it was a trick question. She was actually starting to shake now, partly from cold and partly from the sense that, despite Miss Simpkins' assurance, she was somehow failing a test. Her employer's expression had the brooding, internal look of somebody with a large piece of meat stuck between their back teeth. Could I go into the house now, Miss Simpkin? I'm ever so cold. Yes, of course. Run along. Matty watched her go. What could be done? How could these girls be rescued from the fog in which they were currently wandering, without recourse to the shallow sparkle of film stars?
My guest, Lissa Evans, reading a passage from her new novel, Old Baggage. It's out now in hardback, and many of Lissa's other books, including Wed Wabbit and Their Finest Hour and a Half, are available in a range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. For more information, go to the website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And Lissa will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, actor Sam West on breathing new life into a classic political thriller. But first, it's time to unwrap a very special gift from Anthony McGowan, the author of several books for children and young adults. He was recently in the RNIB Talking Book Studios on a special mission, and that's where I caught up with him. We're very lucky to have Anthony McGowan in the RNIB studio today, where he's been recording a rather special birthday present for RNIB. So, Anthony McGowan, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you, nice to be here. I rather rashly volunteered to read three of my quite short books, Brock, Pike and Rook, for the audiobook library the RNIB have. So I very much enjoyed the last time I came into the studios here, and I thought it might be fun to do this. And how wrong I was.
How have you found the experience?
Well, it's been incredibly challenging for me. I mean, very rewarding as well. But I hadn't realised quite how hard it was going to be to read my own texts out, because I knew them all quite well. I often, as a children's writer, I spend a lot of time visiting schools, so I'm very used to reading out my own works in a kind of performance type way. But it was very different sitting down coolly and calmly and reading it out in the studio when that green light goes on. It was definitely much more taxing and challenging than I thought it was going to be.
And did you find it easy to translate the different voices that you presumably heard in your head when you were writing the different characters into different voices hourly?
Yes, it was. Again, it was one of those challenges. And I'm not an actor. I know that I love audio books, and you know when you've got a good one, that the narrator does wonderful voices. And I assumed that because these were my characters and they lived in my head, then they would come out of my mouth in a fairly straightforward way. But there were various problems with that. One is that these books are all set in Yorkshire, and the characters are all Yorkshire people, which is where I was brought up. But I've lived in London now for many years, since 1989, and it turns out I've almost forgotten how to do a proper Yorkshire accent. And, you know, I can say Bath. After that, I've got to kind of really concentrate, even losing my Yorkshire swear words. So, and also the books involve a range of ages. There are two young characters, there are older characters, there are women, and it definitely stretched my acting abilities to the utmost.
I know that you agreed to come in and record these books after we talked about Rook, which mm-hmm. was the book which was shortlisted for this year's Philip Carnegie Medal. I thought you performed the reading that you did for our programme off the cuff, brilliantly. Clearly, I suppose the nerves kick in a lot more when it's a sort of 3 or 4 hour recording then.
Partly nerves, but also just the amount of energy you need to inject into it. I've just got so much more respect now for the real actors that do this. It's really tiring. You know, I thought it was going to be, you know, like rolling off a log. And again, like you, I have children. I spent, you know, their early years reading to them. Again, that's a much easier experience than actually reading it in that studio. I mean, I've got to say that the technician has been so amazing, so patient with me. I've been stumbling over every paragraph just about, and he's kept saying, "I just do not know." He's a great man.
Well, I heard you talking to him in the kitchen just before we came in here, and what the listeners won't know is that he's blind himself, and you were asking him how he was keeping up with the text, and he told you how he was doing that, didn't he?
Yeah, it's a bit of, you know, I've got slightly geekish tendencies, like many men, and I hadn't realised this was one of the more recent technological developments, that he has a live Braille transcriber. So which turns text into a line of Braille at a time. So he was kind of reading that while listening to me speak. So an incredibly difficult thing to accomplish, as well as all the other technical aspects of the recording that he had to keep in his head. So just massive respect.
Just for listeners who haven't read Brock, Rook and Pike, could you tell us a little bit about the plot so that our young adult listeners can get the books out, hopefully over the summer when they go into the library?
Sure. Well, they centre on the lives of two brothers, Nicky and Kenny. And the younger brother is the carer for the older brother. The older brother's got learning difficulties. And at the beginning of the trilogy, as it was then, I've now actually written the fourth in the trilogy, but their family life is pretty desperate. Their mother's left home. Their father's fallen apart. He drinks too much. He's got in trouble with the police. And in the very first book, Brock, the two brothers get involved with some horrible teenagers who have gone out badger baiting, and the two brothers manage to save a baby badger, and somehow looking after and nurturing the badger helps to begin the healing process in the family. It begins with the family in turmoil and ends with the family back on a more even keel. In the second book, Pike, again, the family's more together. The father's got a nice new girlfriend who helps look after them. But at the beginning of the book, the two boys go fishing, and they see something floating in the water, which might be a body, and it might have a gold Rolex watch on the wrist. And so perhaps they see that as a way of helping to solve some of their financial problems. In the third book, up until this point, Nicky has been the moral centre of the stories, you know, looking after well, keeping the family together. But in the third book, he's a teenager, and it's his turn to go slightly off the rails. And as is so often the case, the catalyst for this is love. He falls in love with a girl at school, and the complicating factor is that her brother is a really horrible bully, and things sort of spiral down for Nicky, and he hits rock bottom, and there's a bit of a bounce up at the end again.
Well, they're a beautiful balance of rites of passage for young adults, and also the nature that surrounds the boys in the Yorkshire countryside that you so clearly love. Mm-hmm. Anthony McGowan, thank you not only for donating the books to the RNIB Library, but also for giving up your time to become the RNIB's newest narrator.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What an amazing gift. Thanks to Anthony and his publisher, Barrington Stoke. Brock, Pike and Rook are all now available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library, including Anthony's fantastic talking book recordings. For more information, visit the library at rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. Samuel West has acting in his DNA. His grandfather was actor Lockwood West, and his parents are Tim West and Prunella Scales. He's equally highly regarded for his performances on stage, screen, and radio. And he's also one of the best audiobook narrators in the business. When I discovered that he was recording new versions of the House of Cards trilogy, I thought it politically expedient to arrange an audience with the great man. Samuel West, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for asking me.
Tell us a little bit more about this new recording of the House of Cards trilogy by Michael Dobbs.
Yes, I've been asked to lay down this new recording of all three Michael Dobbs House of Cards novels, which are a trilogy of political thrillers he wrote in the late 80s and early 90s. And they were made into quite well-known television adaptations almost immediately, adapted by Andrew Davis and with an extraordinary and justly famous central performance from Ian Richardson as Francis Urquhart. And they're all very different in character, so it's been a great job doing them. I'm recording them at ID Audio, and today is our last day of, I think, 12 to get them all done, possibly 13. So it's been quite a big job, but I've enjoyed it very much.
What's it been like spending the last fortnight in the company of one of the nastiest political villains ever created?
Well, the devil gets all the best tunes. If you only played nice people, you'd have a very boring career. And though that might be a rather posh name for the succession of jobs that come my way, I think it's important. And in fact, British actors are particularly good at it. There's a feeling among American film stars in particular that sometimes you're character is the same thing as the parts you choose to play, and therefore people who have a much bigger profile than I do sometimes think that they don't want to play nasty people because their public might not like them. I don't have that problem because I don't really have a public. And also, when you're doing an audiobook, you get to cast it in your head and then play all the parts yourself. So the pleasure of playing somebody really filthily nasty, I mean, as you say, one of the great horrible people in all literature, is extreme. Politically, we don't meet at any point. I'm not sure Michael Dobbs and I meet at any point, but he's an extremely good writer, and he writes the opposition just as well as he writes his own party, and it's been a thrill.
Does it have a particular piquancy reading it in the current atmosphere of political backstabbing to do with Brexit?
It was extraordinary coming to the middle recording of the last book the other day, and where things begin to fall apart around the Prime Minister, and he has a foreign secretary who's on the make, and the Prime Minister is trying to cover up disgraceful details from their own sordid past, and thought plus ça change, really. It was at the point where Boris Johnson had just resigned, and yes, there are dozens of moments where I've wanted to screenshot a particular bit of the book and post it on Twitter and say, look, you know, it's 25 years later and really we haven't improved. But I think that's just good writing, isn't it? It's always up to date. I tell you what is quite depressing is that there's a sense in the books when they're written in the late 80s, early 90s, as I say, that things still matter morally. And people still resign when they do things wrong. And that seems likely to have disappeared. I think it's not unknown now, but it's much rarer. I don't really think the books should be old enough to teach us that yet. You know, they're not that old. We really shouldn't have come out of that bit where if politicians are caught lying or doing something dishonourable, they go. And we seem to have come out of that, which is a bit of a shame, really. But no, a lot of the machinations on both sides are exactly the same. And you know, Michael Dobbs knows of which he speaks extremely well. And it's fascinating. I mean, they're very different characters as books. The first one, which I think made the greatest adaptation, was almost for the first time a sort of fly on the wall peek behind or under the curtain of British politics. It is so detailed and so backstabbing and really fascinating. And then the second one, which has it is at its centre a constitutional battle between Parliament and the monarchy, has as its centre the King, who is modelled on Charles, an unmarried Charles, who eventually abdicates. And that has a very different set of concerns and a very different set of people. But Urquhart and the King are protagonist and antagonist right in the centre of that, and it's a fine battle. The first one is called House of Cards, the second is called To Play the King, and the third is The Final Cut. So he knows his card metaphors. And The Final Cut is a very different beast. It's a sort of military thriller about Cyprus and the division of Cyprus and possible oil beneath Cyprus that is being fought over by Turkish and Greek Cypriots. And Urquhart, it turns out, during his military days, has a dark secret on Cyprus that returns to haunt him. And Michael Dobbs writes a very different sort of book, and I think deliberately so. It's more, you know, Andy McNab than the first one. But it's extremely exciting and very well written. And he also knows a lot about that part of the Mediterranean. And it's shot through with real knowledge and expertise. So I'm enjoying that very much.
How did you go about selecting a voice for Francis Urquhart? Did you find yourself referring back to Ian Richardson, who played Urquhart in the original TV series? Or were you tempted to pick a current political figure and riff on them?
In this case, the marriage between actor and character in Ian Richardson's performance of Francis Urquhart is so total and so historic that it seemed pointless trying to avoid it. I don't do an impression of Ian Richardson, but I discover that I can sound quite like him if I want to. And although Urquhart is, as you know, a Scottish surname, Ian played him as one of those posh Scots that went to boarding school in the Highlands and therefore ended up running the country and doesn't sound Scottish at all. He has a Lowlands burr when he gets tired, we discover. But yes, basically I based it on Ian Richardson and tried to make it a tribute rather than a slavish copy. The interesting thing about the casting of the tellies, which I went back and watched, except the last one, which doesn't have very much to do with it, Andrew did a much more open adaptation of the last book, is that they're so well cast that a lot of the time the people you have in your mind are useful models. You don't try and do impressions of them, but they're very well cast. There's a slight thing that happens in late 80s and early 90s television, which Michael Dobbs is eager to avoid in the way he writes his books, which is that he writes more non-RP voices. There's a boyfriend in the second book who's from Birmingham. There's an investigator who's from Boston in Massachusetts. And in the television adaptation, both of those people become RP. So it's nice to go back to the book and say, actually, you know, politics is a little more diverse and a little more global, or at least a little more national, as written by Michael Dobbs. And we don't have to just kind of do that default white, well-spoken RP thing that happened in a lot of 80s and 90s television and is only really beginning to finish now, I think, with more diversity, which is not before time.
As a blind consumer of audiobooks, it certainly makes it more interesting having a wide selection of voices rather than everyone coming from London or central Glasgow or whatever.
I hope so. I mean, I try and maintain a fairly accurate, you know, cabinet of accents. There are some that I have never worked in except in audiobooks, and I wouldn't put on my CV. And there are others that I would never even attempt without a lot more homework. But when you're casting the thing in your head and then playing the parts yourself, you really are free to be a bit more diverse, and without, you know, it mustn't become the accent show, but politics is properly, or should be, a diverse and wide-ranging, you know, audibly wide-ranging thing. So it's good to be able to, you know, bring some range to that and not to try and narrow everything to your own sort of narrating voice. Although, you know, I'm sometimes tarred with a bit of a posh brush in terms of my television work, which is odd because I grew up in South London, and if I hadn't been brought up by actors, I would probably talk a bit like this. I still do when I go and watch my football team. But I mostly play posh people on television. And when I do audiobooks, it's a bit different. You know, you've got a bit more range. It's a bit like doing radio plays. I played Lenny in The Homecoming, who's in Harold Pinter's play. In fact, I played it opposite him as Max, the patriarch in The Homecoming. And Lenny is a violent East End pimp who sounds a bit like that. And there's no way I would have been given that part on stage. I'm a bit too old, but also people don't think of me in that sort of class and that sort of sound. But when I did it on radio, Harold was graciously pleased to be delighted that I was playing the part, and it's one of my favourite plays, so I was thrilled. So, you know, you just get a chance to do more things with more range. You can be different. You can be someone else.
You've accumulated a remarkable CV of audiobooks. And one of the ones that stood out for me was also picked as one of the top 20 audiobooks of the 20th century, Brighton Rock by Graham Greene. And its protagonist, Pinky, is, of course, another unpleasant working class thug, isn't he?
Yeah, exactly. Pinky's a piece of work. It's a depressing book to read, that. It's interesting. It's probably a 4.5-5 day read, and I remember needing a break in the middle of it. Because you really get quite immersed in this very seedy, loveless world where all emotion is kind of pushed, squeezed out to the edges. And I've done 1984 as well, which unfortunately at the moment isn't available as a recording, which is a shame because it's quite an important book at the moment, and I'd like my recording to be out there, but for some reason it's not been released. It's been withdrawn. But yes, those books are important to, you know, dystopian fictions. It's important to give them their due, even if they are, you know, loveless and violent and sometimes without hope. And then there are other ones which are delightful and much more jolly. I like to mix it up, really. I suppose audiobooks is one of the very few bits of my so-called career where I've got enough work to be able to choose what I do. I can't say, yes, I'd like to do this on television or this in film, whereas audiobook offers come in quite often, and I really like that, and it's nice to be able to say I've got a few days and I'm getting better at it. Last year I did a big record of all the Inspector Morse books, which is 14 novels, and so that's, I don't know, 41 days recording. And I could feel myself getting more fluent. I could feel my reading muscles getting stronger. And they should be pretty strong already.
Is there a book out there that you dream of being asked to narrate?
More a type of book, actually. I'm talking to you today from ID Audio, where Patch McQuaid and I have done two books by Brian Cox, the physicist, The Human Universe and Forces of Nature. And they're about the only audiobooks I've ever done which I listen to. The ones that I've done, partly because my voice sends me to sleep, but partly because there's so much information in there that I want to remember. And Brian is a very great educator and puts things very simply. And I've also got a bit of physics in my background. I did physics A-level and tried to keep up with astronomy and cosmology. And so I'm obviously no expert like he is, but I'm fluent enough to know whether I'm keeping it clear. And I do my homework to make it sure that I understand what I'm saying. I really love doing non-fiction, actually, in that sense, because I learn so much. And sometimes they're a little bit easier to do because you don't have to worry too much about the cast of characters. So you can concentrate on the ideas. And I've really only done two or three non-fiction books. So I think if anybody's listening who want me to do any more of those, I'd be delighted.
You mentioned that you have young children, and I know that another book that you've narrated is the children's classic The Velveteen Rabbit. But are there other children's audiobooks out there that you'd love to narrate? Say one that one of your kids is reading at the moment?
My favourite children's book at the moment is one my daughter, who's 4, has learnt to read by herself first, which is called Colin and Lee Carrot and Pea, which is about the friendship between a pea called Lee and a carrot called Colin, who is orange, and Lee is green. And it's sort of a very light fable about difference and tolerance and how you can be friends, even though you're not very like each other. And it's only about 12 pages long. It's made out of cardboard. It's a very thick book. And it is in its own way an absolutely perfect book. I think recording it would take about 2 minutes. In fact, I probably know it by heart, so I could do it now. But that would be pretty nice. I did Mr. Tiger the other day, which is another one that we read together. And again, that's such a 20-minute record. But it's lovely because you get to do lots of voices and roaring and stuff like that. I mean, the absolute holy grail of children's book recording for me, which I've loved so much that one of my daughter's names is one of the characters in the books, are the Moomins. And if the Moomin books are ever re-recorded and I don't get to do them, there will be trouble.
Well, there you go. Samuel West having a touch of the Francis Urquharts about the Moomins. And you heard it here first. Samuel West, thank you for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you very much for asking.
The air of controlled menace that usually filled the editor's office had vanished, replaced by a brooding sense of panic that was threatening to get out of hand. The first edition had long since gone to press, complete with a bold front page headline proclaiming, "Home and Dry!" But that had been at 6 p.m., 4 hours before the polls closed. The editor of the Daily Chronicle had taken his chance on the election result in order to make his first edition of even marginal interest by the time it hit the streets. If he was right, he would be first with the news. If he got it wrong, he'd be up to his neck in it with the alligators circling. This was Greville Preston's first election as an editor, and he wasn't feeling comfortable. His nervousness showed in his constant change of headlines, his insatiable demand for updates from his political staff, and his increasingly lurid language. He'd been brought in just a few months earlier by the new owner of Chronicle Newspapers, with one simple and irreducible instruction: succeed. Failure wasn't an option in his contract, and he knew he wouldn't be given a second chance, any more than he showed any hint of remorse for the others who worked at the Chronicle. The demands of the accountants for instant financial gratification had required ruthless pruning, and a large number of senior personnel had found themselves being rationalised and replaced by less experienced and considerably less expensive substitutes. It was great for the bottom line, but had kicked the crap out of morale. The purge left the remaining staff insecure, the loyal readers confused, and Preston with a perpetual sense of impending doom, a condition that his proprietor was determined to do nothing to dispel.
My guest, Samuel West, narrating House of Cards, the first book in Michael Dobbs' trilogy of classic political thrillers, which is TB703064. All three titles are being donated to the RNIB Talking Books Library by HarperCollins, as part of a collection of 4,000 audiobooks from their catalogue. Thanks to Samuel West. Do you have a favourite narrator that you'd like us to feature on the show? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
Now, here's Lissa Evans with the books of her life. Lissa, was there a book that you read as a young woman or a child that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Well, there were so many. I did come from a very, very booky family. We were surrounded by books. I came from a family that was so bookish that it wasn't until I was a teenager that I realised that most people don't read during meals. But there was one book that particularly stuck in my memory. We went camping once. We were always going camping. And for some reason, I wasn't actually in the tent. I was in the car, our VW Beetle. I think the tent was full. And I woke up very early. I must have been about 9 and looked around for something to read. And it was rainy outside. And I found a copy of My Family and Other Animals, which my teenage sister was reading. And I picked it up and I was entranced from the first sentence, and I read it all day. I read it through meals, I read it walking along, and I finished it that evening. And it was like eating the most marvellous meal. But it stayed with me forever, and I read it and I reread it. And not only is it full of sunlight and joy and adventure and animals, it's also got the most beautifully constructed jokes in it. And you know, they remained in my head as an example of how to write funny lines. I cried with laughter, and I've always loved it.
"We're waiting for Mother," explained Leslie. "Roger's found a lamppost." "Dear God," said Larry, and then hoisted himself upright in the cab and bellowed, "Come on, Mother, come on! Can't the dog wait? Coming, dear," called Mother passively and untruthfully, for Roger showed no signs of quitting the post. "That dog's been a damn nuisance all the way," said Larry. "Don't be so impatient," said Margot indignantly. "The dog can't help it, and anyway, we had to wait an hour in Naples for you." "My stomach was out of order," explained Larry coldly. "Well, presumably his stomach's out of order," said Margot triumphantly. "It's six of one and a dozen of the other." "You mean half a dozen of the other. Whatever I mean, it's the same thing." At this moment, Mother arrived, slightly dishevelled, and we had to turn our attentions to the task of getting Roger into the cab. He had never been in such a vehicle and treated it with suspicion. Eventually we had to lift him bodily and hurl him inside, yelping frantically, and then pile in breathlessly after him and hold him down. The horse, frightened by this activity, broke into a shambling trot, and we ended in a tangled heap on the floor of the cab, with Roger moaning loudly beneath us.
My Family and Other Animals by Gerald Durrell is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB922. It's narrated by Anthony Parker. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Yes, there is. There is The Shipping News by E. Annie Prue. My mother, who was a tremendous reader, used to read this once a year. And I do the same thing now. And it's partly because I love it and partly, you know, it's a connection with her again. But I absolutely love it. It's the most satisfying of stories. If you haven't read it, it's about a large, shambling man called Coyle who lives in a rather ratty town somewhere in New England with a ghastly wife and two children. His wife leaves him. He's stumbling around with, and then she dies. He's stumbling around with something to do, and he takes his two daughters and he goes to Newfoundland, where the family comes from, together with his aunt, who he's never met before, and establishes a new life in this wild, rocky place, drenched with history, drenched with seawater. And there he finds a new life and he finds himself. But it's funny, it's touching, it tells you about a new world. It's called The Shipping News because he works for the local newspaper there, which mainly covers car smashes. But he becomes a new man there. And it's wonderful. And every time I read it, there are bits I've forgotten. I love that book so much.
Here is an account of a few years in the life of Coyle. Born in Brooklyn and raised in a shuffle of dreary upstate towns. Hive-spangled, gut-roaring with gas and cramp, he survived childhood. At the State University, hand clapped over his chin, he camouflaged torment with smiles and silence. Stumbled through his 20s and into his 30s, learning to separate his feelings from his life, counting on nothing. He ate prodigiously, liked a ham knuckle, buttered spuds. His jobs? Distributor of vending machine candy. All-night clerk in a convenience store. A third-rate newspaper man. At 36, bereft, brimming with grief and thwarted love, Coyle steered away to Newfoundland, the rock that had generated his ancestors, a place he had never been nor thought to go. A watery place, and Coyle feared water, could not swim. Again and again the father had broken his clenched grip and thrown him into pools, brooks, lakes, and surf. Coyle knew the flavor of brack and waterweed. From this youngest son's failure to dog paddle, the father saw other failures multiply like an explosion of virulent cells. Failure to speak clearly. Failure to sit up straight. Failure to get up in the morning. Failure in attitude. Failure in ambition and ability. Indeed, in everything. His own failure. Coyle shambled a head taller than any kid around him. Was soft. He knew it. "Ah, you lout," said the father. But no pygmy himself. And Brother Dick, the father's favorite, pretended to throw up when Coyle came into a room, hissed, "Lard ass, snot face, ugly pig, warthog, stupid, stink bomb, fart tub, grease bag." Pummeled and kicked until Coyle curled, hands over head, sniveling on the linoleum.
William Roberts narrating The Shipping News by Annie Prue, which is TB 15748 and is also available in Braille and giant print. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the RNIB Connect Radio listeners?
Yes, and it's not a new book. I spend far too much time on Twitter, and one author that came up as a recommendation was R.C. Sheriff. Now, I'd only known him as a playwright. He wrote Journey's End, famously. But he was also a novelist and later on a film writer as well. It's simply the story of a family in London in the 1930s going on their fortnight's holiday to Bognor Regis. It's done in tremendous detail. You suddenly realise you've got chapter 5 and they're only at Clapham Junction. But it is tender, it is insightful, it's enormously touching. It's a happy family, but they have their problems as well. There are ambitions that haven't been fulfilled. There are disappointments and sadnesses. But nevertheless, you see their whole lives through the prism of this 2 weeks in Bognor. It's a wonderful book. I'd so recommend it. And I've since read another of his. He's really worth reading.
R.C. Sheriff's The Fortnight in September is available in giant print from the RNIB library, but unfortunately no audiobook version is available either for loan or commercially. Lisa Evans, thank you ever so much for coming into the studio today to share your obvious love of books and reading.
My pleasure.
And don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us via the usual address: readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.